Hello, and welcome to Around It About Chattanooga. I am your host, Michael Edward Miller. My guest today is a Pulitzer Prize-winning investigative journalist who wrote a best-selling book about a real-life mystery. Bill Dedman is a Chattanooga native. He received the Pulitzer in 1989 while writing for the Atlanta Journal-Constitution. These days, he's a reporter for NBC, and a series of reports he did for NBC led to the book that we're going to be talking about. The book is called Empty Mansions: The Mysterious Life of Huguette Clark and the Spending of a Great American Fortune. Bill, welcome to Around It About Chattanooga.
Thank you, Michael.
The backstory behind this book, before we get into exactly what the book is about, the story of how you came to this is pretty interesting right there. I know a lot of times how a reporter gets a story idea is not very interesting, but this time I think it really is. Tell me what happened. You were looking for a house and it kind of led you into this.
Yes, we live in Connecticut outside New York City. My wife, her job was transferred from Boston, where we'd been for a few years, to New York. We were looking for a house, and it was just during a recession. The market had fallen. It was in 2009, and we were trapped as landlords, couldn't sell our house in Boston, and then we couldn't find one we could afford to buy in the Connecticut suburbs. And just, you know how it is, houses are on your mind when you're out shopping. How many bedrooms do we really need? Can we find the right house where our daughters can ride their bicycles? You're thinking houses and square footage all the time. And just for fun, I was looking at the top of the listings in Connecticut just to see what really expensive houses were for sale, sorting the lists that the realtors gave us. And there was a house that had been marked down from $34 million to $25 million.
Quite a bargain there.
Steal.
Yeah.
And 14,000 square feet on 52 acres. And I looked up the property online. I started looking on the town website to see who owned it. And I didn't recognize the name Huguette Clark. That meant nothing to me. But I saw a zoning record. Yeah, I'm a public records reporter. And I read things like zoning records. Nobody else does. And her attorney had told the town this house was last lived in by the previous owner. This owner has not lived in this house. Well, she bought it in 1951.
So more
nearly 60 years earlier.
Yeah, so 60 years not living in this house.
How
I'm sure
that
made you want to know more. So
well, how could it be
worth
that much and no one's lived? So I went over to see it, and there's a little caretaker's cottage, and you can't see the house back in the woods, but you can see the little guard shacks or caretaker's houses. And I rapped on the window, and this old man shuffled out, and he was very polite. He said he'd worked for Miss Clark for at least 20 years, and he'd never seen her. He just got paid by her attorney every month, got his check in the mail. But he'd never met the owner, and no one'd ever lived there. And he asked me as I was leaving, he said, "Do you suppose she's been dead all these years?" Well, I didn't know, but I wanted to find out at that point. It turned out she had a nicer house in California, worth about $100 million overlooking the Pacific in Santa Barbara. And guess what? She hadn't been seen there since the 1950s. And she had apartments in New York City, the apartments every New Yorker would want, overlooking Central Park, except these were huge. She had three apartments in one building, totaling 15,000 square feet. So that'd be five American typical houses. And she wasn't there. The doorman said, "No, at least 20 years we haven't seen her." So I went out to try to find out, well, what happened to her. This is very far from the kind of story I usually do. I usually do investigative stories about systems gone wrong, firefighters whose equipment failed and they died. Did the manufacturer know about that? Who was responsible? Well, this was an odd, quirky mansion mystery, but I wanted to know what had happened to her.
Because it sounds like something nefarious happened to her. If she's got these huge multi-million-dollar mansions and hasn't lived in any of them for decades, you assume maybe she's been kidnapped or being held somewhere against her will or something like that.
And it turned out that she was from an interesting family. Her father was on the magazine covers in the early 1900s. He was well-known across the country and was described in the newspapers as probably the second richest person in America. William Andrews Clark was a U.S. senator from Montana and had struck millions in copper mines, railroads. He founded Las Vegas, which was just a watering stop in Nevada on his railroad, and had resigned from the United States Senate, in effect got pushed out of the U.S. Senate in a bribery scandal. He'd paid the legislators who'd voted for him and sent him to the Senate, and that's one reason that the law, the 17th Amendment was changed, and now voters elect senators instead of the legislatures. Well, here she was, the daughter of this family with an incredible history. Think of the time span. She was born very late in her father's life. He was of age to serve in the American Civil War. He was born in 1839. His daughter was born in 1906 during the Teddy Roosevelt administration. And here she was, still alive, somewhere, in the Obama administration.
And you finally tracked her down to a hospital, Beth Israel Hospital in New York. And the weird thing was, although she'd been there for 20 years, there was nothing physically wrong with her.
Exactly. In the end, it turned out that she had been sick. She had gone into the hospital. It made more sense once we looked into it, but to some extent. She had some facial cancers. She'd been an outdoors girl when she was a youngster, and she ended up in her 80s with cancers on her face that were untreated. She'd gone to the hospital near death because she couldn't eat anymore. And they got her fixed up, and she said, well, I like it here. I want to stay. So she paid about $400,000 a year in rent to the hospital. And though, for most of those years, all she took was a daily vitamin. She wasn't sick at least. She'd get a cold or she'd get the flu occasionally, but mostly healthy. For 20 years, living in a very simple hospital room, while just across town, her apartments still had paintings by Monet and Renoir and Degas and fine furniture, and in California and Connecticut, she had these big estates that were empty, but still very carefully maintained. She was on the phone with the caretakers, making sure that they were painting and fixing and gardening, even though she no longer visited.
And at that point, the story question becomes, is she really mentally competent? Does she really understand where she is and what's going on? Is she really in this hospital for two decades voluntarily? And your book makes a pretty compelling case that she was actually where she wanted to be and she was completely mentally competent. Why do you say that in the book? What is some of the evidence that she was really just doing what she wanted to be doing?
Well, there was a lot of smoke that got my attention, sort of converting this mystery that was a bit of a lark into something closer to my normal work. I mean, an investigative story, and that got the, for example, the district attorney and its elder abuse unit looking into it, because her attorney and her accountant had been selling some things. She'd sold a Stradivarius violin for $6 million and a Renoir painting for $23 million. Her home in Connecticut was for sale, and so the question became: does she know that her property is being sold off? And the more we looked into it, in the end, the investigation went nowhere. She had signed authorizations. She was quite lucid, according to those who talked to her. My co-author in the book is her cousin, who joined forces to work on this. He'd been writing a history of her father and had looked up the elder relatives in the family, and he'd reached to get Clark in the hospital. He talked with her on the phone over a 9-year period and has notes and even tape recordings of some of the phone calls. And you can hear her voice on the audiobook of our Empty Mansions. And she has a perfect memory. When he misstates the name of a hotel at Waikiki Beach where she stayed in 1915, she knows the name. She recalls having tickets on the Titanic for the return trip, which of course never happened. Has an excellent memory. She's quite appropriate and lucid and clear. Which was quite a surprise, but she is was a world-class eccentric. She died at age 104, just a couple weeks short of her 105th birthday. And it turned out that she was just a shy artist, painter, collector of dolls, collector of fairy tale little story houses that she would design, collector of Japanese books and little castles and other artwork. And a serious amateur painter. herself, a portrait painter and landscape painter. And she just preferred to live quietly without most of the entitlements of the great wealth that she had been born into. I think one of the questions that the book raises is how would we have lived our lives if we had started out with her advantages and disadvantages? Think of it. When she was a child in New York, she lived in the largest house in New York City, 121 rooms for a family of four and the 13 servants. That sort of situation might give you a skewed perspective about what money's for and how to keep your privacy and what was important to you and what wasn't.
If you're just joining us, I'm talking with Bill Dedman. He co-wrote the book Empty Mansions about a mysterious heiress. You started this book as a series of investigations for NBC, and when you were just doing the investigative stories before the book, it got a tremendous amount of online traffic, tremendous amount of response from NBC viewers. You got a lot of emails and letters. Why did people connect so much with this story of this heiress who was so reclusive?
It was astonishing. I was surprised. A couple of thousand emails, 110 million page views on the website. We never expected that there'd be so much interest in it. I think the span of history that I described was surprising to people. How could someone be alive whose father had been of age to serve in the Civil War and whose grandfather, her grandfather, was born the year George Washington gave up the presidency? So that you have the whole history of the country there in three individuals in a family. But I think that the wealth, the extravagant, over-the-top wealth, the idea of having houses that you don't need, that you can keep, that you can afford to pay $60,000 a year for property taxes in Connecticut. Her monthly expenditures were about $400,000 a month. And, you know, how is that possible? This came during a time when there was a lot of discussion in the country about the wealth gap and income disparities, and it came just after a real estate crash. And a lot of us were hurting, some hurting at a higher level than others, but a lot of people were suffering during that time and still are. And I think in light of that, the sort of Gilded Age extravagance and wealth, it seemed to me that she offered something of a window into that. And we were able to piece it together. You know, it sort of reminded me of after my grandmother died. She lived over in a little town called Morrison near McMinnville in Manchester. And we were having a sale to sell some of her things and sell her house. And we're going through the attic looking at what to keep, what to throw away, what to sell. And there were hats from the 1940s. There were letters from my grandfather in World War I. There were a ledger book where she kept track of trying to save enough money to buy one piece of furniture for the house each year. And, you know, I knew my grandmother well, and you know, that dining room table that she bought is in my son's house in Tyner today. But even if you know somebody, though, what they bought, what they wrote, what they memorized, what they chose to keep, tells you something about her. And the experience of writing this book was similar to that. We had 20,000 pages of her correspondence, and 4,000 pages of that was in French, with writing to a boyfriend in Paris. We had a lot of her sort of collected artwork and her personal stories from the audio tapes as well. And for me, it felt like trying to piece together, not someone I knew well like my grandmother, but trying to piece together the life of someone I hadn't met. And in the end, I felt as though the choices that she made, while seemingly from the outside so bizarre, were reasonable and made good sense from her perspective.
Talking with Bill Dedman. He's a Chattanooga native, Baylor School graduate. You'll be here back in Chattanooga on Tuesday, March 11th, for an event at the Public Library with the Chattanooga Writers Guild. What are you going to be talking about on the 11th?
Yeah, I'm going to be talking about a specifically about this book, and we'll show some pictures from the book, and I'll talk about the choices that we made in writing a nonfiction book and trying not to put thoughts into anyone's head, which is an important aspect for me of I feel my role as a journalist, our roles as authors were to tell what we knew and how we knew it, and also to tell what we didn't know or what we had conflicting information about, and tried to leave to the reader to make judgments. For example, Yvette Clark was relentlessly generous. She surprised strangers with $30,000 gifts. She gave a huge amount of money to her nurse, one of her nurses, the day nurse for 20 years. She and her family received more than $30 million in gifts from Yvette during that 20-year period. And this is a series of events you can get a bar fight started on. Is this unethical? Does it violate the code? Is this completely outrageous for the nurse to accept these gifts? Or if Yvette wants to give 10% of her net worth to the woman who's been caring for her for 20 years, that's their business. We wanted to leave room on that and other questions for the readers to make up their own mind, giving them the best information that we could and working it into the narrative, but being very clear but not judgmental and not guessing what sort of feeling someone had.
Are you a fan of The Twilight Zone?
Well, I've seen maybe a dozen episodes. It was not my favorite. I was wasting my youth reading magazine. And
There's this one episode, I think probably one of the most famous episodes of The Twilight Zone, about this little boy who anything he wishes for instantly comes true.
Mm.
And he becomes kind of a monster. He controls this whole town.
Yeah.
And Huguette's story kind of reminded me about that, except whereas this Twilight Zone story was a horror story, she used her wealth to grant every wish she would want. But she also, as you were saying, used her wealth to help people. It's really interesting the way it turned out, this woman who has virtually unlimited power through wealth and how she used it to lead exactly the life she wanted and help others.
You know, it's funny. Reading the comments of readers on Amazon or Goodreads or the other sites and from the emails that we get, a lot of people say, well, this is a very sad story. She didn't go out of the house for 20 years, and she hadn't been out much since the 1930s or certainly the 1950s. And but those close to her all said that she didn't at all seem to be sad, and she doesn't sound sad at all in her telephone conversations with Paul Clark Newell, her cousin, who's the co-author of the book. She sounds chipper, friendly, maybe even a little, you know, needy for conversation. She was the sort who would call her friends several times during the day, spend a lot of time on the phone with friends. But she was able to get her connection to people through letters and emails. She was quite uncomfortable with people in person. I mean, spectacularly uncomfortable, such as one of her attorneys represented her for more than two decades, handling all of her business. And never met her in person. He would talk to her on the phone and occasionally through the door when he'd come to drop something off. But he died never having laid eyes on her. She was quite uncomfortable, even with people she'd been in contact with for a long time. Paul, her cousin, never knew she was living in a hospital. She called him. He never called her. And if he wanted to talk to her, he'd call her lawyer, who'd pass on the message, and she'd call Paul back. She was exceedingly private, but there's just not any indication that she was sad about the choices that she made or what she may have given up. I mean, you and I, if we had that wealth, would have a nicer view.
Yes.
You know, she loved Japan. She collected memorabilia. She painted Japanese scenes, etc. And she knew the history of Japan to great detail. And so Paul asked her quite reasonably, so, Yvette, when did you last visit Japan? And she said, oh, no, I've never gone, without any hint of regret whatsoever. You know, she'd traveled in Europe when she was a child and to Paris and was there when World War I began. The family castle in France was destroyed by the Germans in World War II. I mean, she'd been out in the world, but seemed quite comfortable in her old age, in her 80s and 90s, and past 100, living in a hospital room.
It's really interesting because you were writing nonfiction and really sticking with the facts, so you couldn't tell us what Huguette was thinking. And as a reader reading the book, that's one of the main things that I wanted to know is what is going through her mind when she's, for example, deciding to stay in a hospital for 20 years, even though she has these beautiful mansions she could be living in. What was that like for you, just deciding to not try to speculate on what she was thinking, try to not get inside of her head?
Right. Well, we knew what she told people. She felt safer there. You know, one person, an older person knocking around in 42 rooms with paintings by Monet, and she had an intruder once that got in. It's not an especially safe environment for one person. So it's not as unreasonable as it sounds. The oddity is that she then kept the houses, even though she never used them again. I, as a journalist, I don't think it's my role to say what people are thinking. On NPR, I'll pick on you for a moment. You know, when the news, next news spot comes on, the reporters from Washington will tell you what people are thinking. The CIA believes that Syrian army, every time someone says something, it's introduced by that person believes or so-and-so thinks. And I think we can all agree that among the things the reporters can't possibly know is what the CIA believes.
Yeah.
It's not our job. We know what people say, and they do, and what they write, and the choices that they make, but we don't know what they think.
No. We know what they say they think, but that may or may not be the truth. They may not even know why they did something or what they truly believe about a subject.
Yes, it might come as a surprise that even in Washington, sometimes people don't quite give you the real reason that they're doing something.
Speaking of investigative journalism, you for 6 years served on the board of directors of the Investigative Reporters and Editors. What do you think of the current state of investigative journalism in the world and the United States?
Well, you know, IRE just had a conference this past week in Baltimore. It's a training organization. It's a self-help and training group that gets together twice a year. And one of the things you come away from their meetings seen quite clearly is that there's a lot of good reporting going on. A reporter in Charleston, West Virginia, has been doing great work on the environmental problems there and the water spills, the chemical spills into the water that have been happening. I mean, a reporter has been digging in for decades and doing good work time after time. And you have that sort of good reporter all around the country. Where there's been a decline is at the largest news organizations and at the emphasis that some papers have put on, especially newspapers, have put on investigative reporting. But you've had good watchdog reporting at the Chattanooga Times.
Oh, yes.
Press, and there are, it's still a priority at a lot of news organizations. I think it's a little too glib the way people will say, there's just no investigative reporting anymore. Sometimes what they mean by that is, you know, they don't agree with politically with they find some truth uncomfortable that's been pointed out.
Or it's just it's not whatever they think is going on is not being investigated. Maybe they believe something, but they don't really have their facts straight on it. And they think we should reporting what they believe as opposed to what actually happened.
Yeah, there's a lot of assumptions. I mean, for example, I did a lot of stories about the White House visitors in the Obama administration and the failure to release for a time, now some of that information is out, but to release the logs of who visited the White House so we could check on whether or not lobbyists were or were not visiting, for example. And you do a story like that, and then you might do a story, let's say it's about voting rights laws and efforts that have the effect, if not the intent, of keeping more minorities from voting. And the email comes in and says, "Oh, you're just a reporter at NBC. You're a New York liberal, and you are just carrying water for the Obama administration." And I just write back and say, "Well, where were you when I was writing about the Obama administration?" Well, you didn't. And people are, you know, it's easy to be very intemperate I got a very scathing and crude email from a man, and he had his address on it, and he lived on Signal Mountain.
Oh, wow.
Well, so I called him up. You know, his wife taught with my mother in the Hamilton County school system. And, you know, once we got to chatting for a while, if I had met him at Radio Shack in Red Bank, he would never have said the things that he felt so easy about firing off in an email, into the ether. It comes with the territory.
It really does. Yeah, we get it here. You just even with what we do, and even the music shows, we get it. We get all sorts of unsolicited feedback, some of it good, some of it just inscrutable.
Yeah. What I like about it is that we get a lot of good story ideas, though. I try to hang my shingle out as much as possible. You know, my little profile page online begs for story ideas. And most of the stories that have worked out well for me have been ones that came in from readers that weren't some political rant, but were a bona fide idea, and here's a document, and here's the three people you should talk to, and this story matters. It's not just what happened to me in my one situation, but this is something going on that matters to people across the country. And those ideas come in from readers. One of the problems that news organizations have is that let's say you're covering schools and you do a good job on some story and they say, oh, you have investigative skills, then we take you off the school's beat and we call you an investigative reporter and we therefore cut you off from the source of story ideas. You're no longer covering a topic every day. And so if you've been put off in that corner, you have to work hard to connect with readers because they're the ones who have the ideas.
Because you've got to develop those sources, those people who trust you and will give you information they wouldn't give to anybody else.
Well, I've never been a sort of like a Bob Woodward Watergate reporter. No one's ever met me in a parking garage, and I've gotten no stories in parking garages. I've always been more of a documents and records person. When I covered the courthouse in Chattanooga for the Times or just, all along the line, I've really been one more to rely on pinning stories down from the documents and the records.
Oh, that's interesting. Why do you think that is?
I think part of it is that, for example, there I was competing with a reporter who'd been on the beat 20 years at the Free Press.
Oh, yeah.
30 years, maybe. And he knew everybody, and they were going to tell him all the good news. If the county had a new plant, the Komatsu plant came in out there on the at the foot of Signal Mountain. Well, he was going to get that story, not I. But if I dug into the records, I might find stories that were not being handed out. And that was you could think of it as just sort of tacking away from your weakness.
Did you leave before the two papers merged?
Yes. It was the early 80s. I went to Knoxville and then Atlanta. So I miss the merger. I have a lot of friends who are still at the paper, and I'm going to be spending some time with them in the newsroom on Tuesday. And I've seen online quite a few good projects and stories that continue to be done there.
Definitely. They really are a world-class newspaper, I think. They did something not too long ago on shootings here in Chattanooga and why, the zip code you live in and the color of your skin has a lot to do with whether or not your shooting is going to get prosecuted.
It's very hard with a smaller staff to maintain that, necessarily that sort of thing is going to be episodic, right? You're going to have the big hit from time to time. The trick is to try to figure out how to work it into daily coverage. Having the paragraph, the watchdog paragraph, the computer assisted paragraph, the working with the document, that's much harder really than that integrating it with daily work is really much harder to accomplish and maintain than doing the occasional big story.
Getting back to your book, Empty Mansions, one thing I thought was interesting in the book itself. I didn't ever see a part where you personally had met with or interviewed Huguette Clark. Did you attempt to contact her? Was that something you wanted to do?
No. You know, once I found out she was in the hospital room, I sort of lurked around the hospital. I mean, I figured out what section she was in. I talked to someone who worked in that section, and I got a good description of how they had changed the name on her doors to give her an alias. And, you know, I was getting that kind of color, but I did not want, I just saw no advantage in me barging into the hospital room of an elderly woman. I just couldn't see how that was a good plan. When I was 25, I probably would have gone right up to her door, but I just didn't see the point in doing that. And then I got connected to Paul, her cousin, who talked to her on the phone, and then after she died, we were able to see her correspondence and to reveal her personality in that way, see her paintings. For me, one of the fun things was trying to piece together the past and give the reader to put the reader in that time and place. So, for example, we had a lot of photographs of the family, and I sat with a professor of the history of fashion. I didn't know there was such a thing. At New York University, we talked about what's a cloche hat and the bell-shaped hat, or what's a hobble skirt, and we talked about the clothing. And I took her some of her paintings and pictures of them to an art professor, and took pictures of the gardens and a house in California to a landscape designer. We talked about what the trees were. Was for me part of the fun of the research was trying to build up that world that she was born into, of great wealth and privilege, but also tinged with political scandal, living from 1906 to 2011. If you think about it, she had tickets on the Titanic, and she lived in Manhattan on 9/11 when the World Trade Center was attacked.
I think there are very few people who could say they've witnessed that many events.
Now, if she had gone on the Titanic, that is, if she'd gone on the first voyage, and she had tickets on the second voyage, if she had gone on the first voyage and lived to 104, she would have been the oldest surviving.
Wow.
Passenger.
What is your sense of her ultimately? Because I think that's still one of the questions that her relatives are still fighting over. Was she competent? Was she lucid? Did she really understand the world around her? What did you think of her?
Right. Well, we haven't touched on the battle over the will.
Yes.
Her family was disinherited. What family, you might ask? Well, her father from her first marriage had children. And so the grandchildren of those children showed up in court. Some of them had had contact with her through the years, but very little. The last time any of them saw her was at a family funeral in 1968. And the last time any of them talked to her was in the 1950s. And that's partly because of her reclusiveness and partly because of their lack of interest. And it seemed to me that she was quite generous to people she knew. She gave to institutions. She gave to an art museum, for example, the Corcoran in Washington, where her father's art collection is the bulk of its collection. But she seemed quite generous, but in the sort of way that preserves your privacy, where you're giving anonymously or you're giving to individuals whom you know. I think the reader may think that she's selfish. You know, if you're spending $15,000 or $20,000 at a throw buying antique French dolls, which were her passion, and you're turning down charitable requests that come to you from an orphanage that your father established, then you might think her selfish. I thought that just what happened was that the privacy overrode. She was cautious and she was private, and very much in control. She was not in any way a pushover, but she clearly had some social disability. I mean, whether it was something that she might have had a diagnosis for. She never got a diagnosis, but might have qualified for some sort of obsessive compulsive disorder, maybe, or some extreme shyness. But within the world that she controlled, letter writing, and check writing, and phone calls, correspondence, negotiating purchases of paintings and violins and the like, she was She was completely in control, to a point where it was maddening to her advisors. They wanted her to sign a will. She'd left everything to her mother in an earlier will where her mother was dead 50 years, and they couldn't get her to sign one, a new will, until very late in her life. She had at $1.5 million in a checking account, earning no interest. And they kept saying, that could earn you $300,000 or $400,000 a year, back when savings accounts paid interest. And she wouldn't move it over. She had some stubbornness that she clearly got from her father. But I in the end found her likable, maddening perhaps, but completely benign. How many people born into that great wealth would go through their whole life with leaving no record of anyone saying that they ever said an unkind word or did anything, caused any malefaction with their great wealth?
Her father. Go ahead.
Go ahead.
Her father was villainized in history. He was really history did not treat him kindly. Because of all the scandals about him maybe buying his way into office and all these things. Do you think that had anything to do with her reluctance to ever come out in public, seeing the way that her father was treated by the press and treated by other people?
We don't know what her reaction to that was. She spoke of her father with great fondness. She would refer to her dear father. She would show people the family home, the great mansion on Fifth Avenue that she grew up in. She would show them pictures of that, show that to nurses and doctors and visitors. She didn't seem ashamed of her father or mother or her family in any way. It's hard to imagine that it wouldn't have had some connection. You know, she was at a private school in New York City, a private school for girls. She would have been the wealthiest, from the wealthiest family in school. And here was her father on the cover of Collier's or McLean's or the other magazines. In political cartoons, depicted like a cat with dollar signs for eyes that keeps getting kicked out of the U.S. Senate and is meowing at the door. That can't have been very pleasant for her. Her life as a child was much more public. She was in the cartoons herself as a spoiled little rich girl.
Huh.
And the family was. Threw the house open for parties. Her father had 5 art galleries in the house and would invite the public in on Saturday afternoons to tour the art. There were fundraisers for charities there all the time at the house. But after the father died and the great house was sold, mother and daughter seemed to have preferred a much quieter life and moved into apartments in the same building, separate apartments, where they enjoyed music for the mother and painting for the daughter, and would go out, in the 1950s, went out to have her Stradivarius violin restrung. But she would go up Fifth Avenue for a Dior clothing fashion show because she needed more clothes for her doll. But they weren't in the society pages anymore, and that must have been closer to their preference, because that's what they did. That's what they chose.
Well, in the book, the father, despite him being so outgoing and having all these political aspirations and all these very public parties in his house, is still often described as an introvert. It's an interesting dynamic.
Yes. In a way, he's an archetypal American figure. He wasn't born in poverty. He wasn't quite a Horatio Alger character, but he was born in a middle-class farm in Pennsylvania. And ended up in Colorado and then up in Montana in the gold rush days, and eventually getting rich in copper and as a banker. And, he was the sort who would not only be chosen to lead the Constitutional Convention twice in Montana. He was the head of the Masons in the state. He ran for political office many times. We've met a person like that, people like that in town. But he was not much of a conversationalist. He wasn't a backslapping politician. He was a little uncomfortable. with strangers, and maybe some of that rubbed off on his daughter. I think the reader gets whiplashed a little bit with W.A. Clark. He's a likable character. He's a romantic. He's reading poetry. He's studious. He's lucky, and he's clever, and he's honest in business. But his desire for social acceptance, this building the gaudy house, and his desire for acclaim of getting the title of senator, makes him not so likable. And then the political corruption pretty much sealed his reputation for life.
Until I read the book, I wasn't really aware of W.A. Clark at all, even though he was such a big figure in history back then. Why do you think that is, that he's not more well-known today along with the Rockefellers?
Well, the Rockefellers have the Rockefeller Foundation, Rockefeller Center and Plaza, and the Christmas tree you lit up there every year, and the Carnegies have libraries all across America. And, you know, Andrew Carnegie said that you're supposed to study in the first third of your life and make money in the second third and give it away in the third. Well, W.A. Clark lived into his 80s, but he never got to that third. He gave relatively little away. He gave his art collection primarily, as a monument to himself, partly. And so I think that lack of charity, you know, Carnegie was a true robber baron. The Standard Oil men working for Rockefeller committed a lot of crimes, and that's completely forgotten. It's completely wiped away. You'll see that on the History Channel, but they're remembered as philanthropists. And there's probably some lesson there for today's Clarks. And, you know, it's hard to argue, reading the story of You Get Clark, it's hard to argue against Warren Buffett or Bill Gates' plan to leave relatively little to their children. They're not impoverishing them, but they're leaving them relatively little and giving the rest away. And it's hard to argue against that as not only a kindness to society, but to your family as well. There are disabilities of having great wealth.
Well, it is. I think it gets back to that idea of, if you have the power to grant any wish you want of your own, then you're not really motivated to get out of that hospital and see the world or do anything that you don't immediately want to do at that moment.
Right. You know, she didn't even have a nice view from the hospital room. So, and seemed perfectly content. I don't want to go beyond what we know, but it does seem as though the fantastic circumstances of her youth gave her a perspective. She would ask her attorney, he says, you know, just constantly, she would ask him, well, can I afford that? You know, I want to do this. Can I afford it? And the hospital, in the book part of the story, is the hospital pestering her for gifts while she lives there. Of course, it's a nonprofit hospital, and they had a woman with $300 or $400 million living in the hospital. So, of course, they were asking her for gifts. And at one point, they asked her to buy the building. You know, we can stay in this building if you'll give us $125 million so we don't have to sell it to a developer and you won't have to move. And she called and asked her attorney, can I afford it? Which, of course, she could. But she didn't quite have the cash for it, and he dissuaded her from doing it. But she clearly had a different perspective than we did on what's a reasonable price.
The book is called Empty Mansions, The Mysterious Life of Huguette Clark and the Spending of a Great American Fortune. You wrote it along with Paul Clark Newell, one of Huguette's relatives, although he's not one of the ones who's involved in the lawsuits now over her fortune. How can listeners find the book?
So the website is emptymansionsbook.com. And all the bookstores have it. And on the website, we have pictures and some videos, a video of her doll collection, for example. You may be the kind of person who thinks dolls are elegant, or you may be like my wife, the sort who thinks that they're creepy. But either way, you can see some of her dolls at emptymansionsbook.com.
Bill Dedman, thank you so much for talking with me. Is there anything else you want to say?
No, thank you, Michael. I'm very excited about this visit back to Chattanooga. I'm going to be meeting with Baylor School students on Monday, and then we have this public event at the public library at 6:30 on Tuesday, and with the Chattanooga Writers Guild, and going back to my old haunts at the newspapers. So it's all very exciting to have a chance to do that.
Well, I am looking forward to you coming back here. Thank you so much.
Thank you.